This weekend shootings in Philadelphia and Chattanooga were the latest in this country's epidemic of gun violence. A bipartisan group of senators is trying to negotiate a package of solutions by week's end. Now, many see the National Rifle Association as a roadblock to all this, though NRA members and supporters say it defends their rights. So we want to revisit our chat with NPR reporter Tim Mak. His book is Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA, and it looks at the long and tenuous reign of Leader Wayne LaPierre. Tim, let's start with Wayne LaPierre. He has headed the NRA since 1991, and you portray him as a deeply flawed, indecisive character, scared of conflict, scared of public speaking. Tell me a story that goes to his person.
What I was so interested in with the NRA is that it was a total black box. A lot of people know its public persona, but very, very few people know its private characters and personalities. And one of the weirdest is Wayne LaPierre. And as you learn more about him from people who know him best, you really realize that the public persona as this kind of hardline gun rights advocate is a facade. Deep inside, he's an anxious, weak-willed, nervous person, and that a lot of people around him get what they want because if they berate him long enough, eventually he yields. I start the book at his wedding in the late 90s, and he does not want to get married. Eventually, the hour of the wedding comes, and he just doesn't show up. And the best man is very much for Wayne LaPierre not getting married that day. Puts a $100 bill on the dashboard of the car and says, "Hey, Wayne, we can get out of here." But ultimately, Susan and the priest have a talking to with Wayne, and they bug him, they yell at him until he eventually agrees. And then you have this scene of Wayne LaPierre getting married, refusing to make eye contact with his bride. It was a deeply awkward scene, but it shows a lot about the person who has led this National Rifle Association for so many years.
You write that Wayne LaPierre and his wife also had this crazy lavish lifestyle. What did you find in your research and what became public through public investigation?
Yeah, well, what you see through my interviews, thousands of pages of secret documents, depositions, and other investigations, is you see that tens of millions of dollars has gone into spending of nonprofit funds. We're talking millions of dollars in private jet travel, six figures in suits for Wayne LaPierre, exotic trips, and so on and so on.
And as you write, a lot of this is funneled through the NRA's marketing firm.
For a long time, the NRA had a kind of symbiotic relationship with a PR agency called Ackerman McQueen. And one of the ways that Wayne and his wife Susan would hide some of their spending was that they would use Ackerman McQueen credit cards to spend on their trips. And then Ackerman McQueen would bill that back in nondescript ways to the NRA, and it would just look like the NRA was paying its PR firm.
Wow. Now, one thing I got to ask you about that really gets me about Wayne LaPierre is he doesn't even love guns.
Yeah, he's not really into it. And in fact, he's a pretty bad shot. He can be downright dangerous from times. I mean, there was a joke inside NRA headquarters that if you didn't do well on your, say, quarterly reviews, you would have to go, quote, shooting with Wayne.
Now, let's talk about the evolution of the NRA over the last decade as you write it. You have one chapter called The NRA Before Sandy Hook, and that, of course, is the horrific murders of 20 elementary school children and six adults in Connecticut in 2012. How did the NRA, its policies, its lobbying change after that?
Well, you know, that period shows a lot of the internal conflict inside the NRA. On the one hand, the NRA has a lot of lobbyists, and those lobbyists go on Capitol Hill and they try to make legislation. But then there's the pull of its PR people, it's people who are fundraising, it's people who are interested in raising money. And the incentives for those people trying to gin up membership is to have a more extreme voice and a more extreme stance. You'll remember after Sandy Hook that the NRA suggests more guns in schools. This is something that a lot of the lobbyists were appalled by. And you see the NRA really evolve past that point after Sandy Hook by doubling down on the conservative culture war and deciding to only pursue Republicans as legislative allies and give up even the pretense of reaching out to moderate Democrats.
All right, so then we fast forward, I guess not to the next mass shooting, because we know there were hundreds of them, but to Parkland, Florida, right? 17 high schoolers, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas School, murdered. And that event changed so much of the mood in the country. Did it change anything inside the NRA?
Well, you know, like over the intervening years between Sandy Hook and Parkland, one thing that really changed in America was the growth of a grassroots gun safety movement. Groups like March for Our Lives and also Every Town, as well as Moms Demand Action. These groups find some voice after Sandy Hook so that by the time Parkland happens, they're really challenging the NRA on a grassroots and spending level. In fact, in 2018, the opponents of the NRA outspent them for the first time in history. So there's a lot of upheaval in the NRA during this period. In 2018 and 2019, internal conflicts in the NRA lead to a confrontation. By 2019, the president of the NRA is a man that many of our listeners might be familiar with, Oliver North. And he kind of comes into the organization trying to fix things. And the more he learns, the more he sees that there's corruption at the very top of the organization. And that leads him to a very climactic battle with Wayne LaPierre that culminates in a confrontation in an Indianapolis hotel suite in April of 2019.
But before we get to today, I want to spin you back to the chapters in your book about Russia. Many of us have heard about Maria Butina, convicted 3 years ago for being an unregistered foreign agent. How did she play the NRA to gain access to the highest levels of the U.S. government?
So I was curious to know, did the Russian government do anything to benefit the NRA? But it turns out the NRA kind of got played, that Maria Butina, this Russian citizen who came to the United States and tried to network and infiltrate the National Rifle Association, gets the NRA to pay for her trips, her networking for the purpose of benefiting the Russian government, gets the NRA to help her pay for the NRA to go to Moscow, for example, in 2015. The National Rifle Association ends up being putty in her hands.
And the members of the NRA, the staff, the executives, do they know this is going on?
At the time, there were some weird questions about, hey, who is this Russian citizen who's running around in our ranks and networking with all these million-dollar donors and executives? But it was not clear at the time exactly what was happening.
And then, of course, the NRA supports Donald Trump and, you know, it, I guess, moves rightward in these culture wars. But eventually, as you write, the walls start to cave in. Right? LaPierre seems to turn on his own people and his own marketing firm that you've described. He nudges out board members and Oliver North. Tell me what it is about Wayne LaPierre or about what he did that allows him to be still standing.
I think this goes back to the fact that although he is someone who is remarkably weak-willed, he's still someone who wants to survive. One person in the book is quoted as saying that he's kind of like a hyena who's a scavenger, but if he's wounded and backed into a corner, all animals will defend themselves and act out. Wayne LaPierre, in that way, has been able to survive because he's worried about what would happen if he were to leave the National Rifle Association. And for so long, so many people and powerful people in the NRA depend on him to do their bidding. And so he's managed to find some coalition to keep himself at the very head of the National Rifle Association.
I mean, the title of your book is The Downfall of the NRA. But in the middle of these investigations, these lawsuits you describe, the National Rifle Association is not necessarily down and out.
Yeah, they've still got millions and millions of members. But over the next little while, we'll see the development of a couple key things, including the New York Attorney General's efforts to dissolve the National Rifle Association entirely. Over the last 2 years or so, the New York Attorney General has been investigating and later filing in court an attempt to dissolve the NRA entirely due to what they've found is tens of millions of dollars worth of misconduct and misspending.
And finally, Tim, tell me about the writing of this book. What surprised you the most?
Well, you know, the process of writing the book was really interesting because it was written over the last few years, but a lot of breakthroughs came during kind of the worst days of the pandemic. And a source finally indicated that the source was willing to meet and provide hundreds and hundreds of pages of secret depositions, which are kind of the gold standard of evidence. And so I end up renting a moped because there's no public transit available. And I end up driving what seems like hours and hours, meeting in a parking lot. And the source rolls down the passenger side window and says, the documents are on the seat there. And so I reach in, grab the documents, and put in my backpack and just kind of moped off. And those documents form some of the most basic structure of this book. Senior leaders of the NRA speaking in their own words about who said what, in what room, and what was said exactly. Not a lot of people have known a lot about the personalities and the players inside the group.
The book is Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA, and the author is Tim Mack, NPR's Washington investigative correspondent. Tim, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks so much for taking the time.